Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's show. I am Lisa Anderson. A little preview of what is coming up. First up, we have our friend Jackson Dunn, relationship expert, here to answer a question about what church to attend after you get engaged. How do you make that decision to merge lives and merge churches? It can be tricky. Then for our culture segment, Peter and Kelly Worrell are here to talk about their new book about what they would tell their 20-something selves. So a lot of great advice born out of their own experience, and hopefully some of that you'll be able to take away as well. And it applies to, you know, if you're beyond your 20s, hey, there's stuff in there for you too. So all good stuff. But here we are for our roundtable today. We're actually going to be talking around the theme of what does our faith look like when it is applied to everyday life? So kind of that idea of moving out of this mentality that our faith is just a ticket to heaven. It's just what we do to be reconciled to God. It's just this one and done kind of mentality. We walked an aisle, we prayed a prayer. What does our faith actually mean when the rubber hits the road for both good, for bad, for the big things, for the small things? And so I'm excited to invite Ashley, Diane, and Bobby here. Hey, y'all.
Hey.
Thanks. Hi there. Thanks for having us.
Very exciting to have you all. Okay, well, let's just start talking about this because I think this is fun stuff and certainly something that I'm sure you all have grappled with. We're all different places, not that we have to like name or state ages or anything, but let's
it's
just say
all right, just say it.
Diane, bless her heart. We're all just at different stages in life, okay? Mm-hmm. That's okay. And so these are going to, it's going to affect our answers differently. And so that's great. We have a bunch of different perspectives here. So I think we can all agree that if we look biblically at Christianity, we understand that the work of Christ on the cross and his resurrection is a means of reconciling us to God. And there is an element of we were dead in our transgressions. We were completely without hope. We were not looking for God and thinking, oh my goodness, the one thing I need in my life is more Jesus because I'm horrible. You know, I mean, none of us want right. to think that. We want to think we're good people, but we're not. So Jesus Christ has made a means for us to be reconciled to God. And one of the provisions out of that is an eternity with the Father and the Son. So anyway, so all that to say, that is true. But I like to think, and I don't know if y'all agree with this, but I mean, I think you do because don't we all believe the Bible, that we're actually living in eternity. I mean, we are eternal beings. Right. So eternity has started, people.
Yes.
Even though we are still living in a world where the devil has some dominion, which is not good, but it is true. So that said, what does it look like, again, as I introed this, for the gospel to be lived out in our life as it is right now? What is the application for now? And so if you could, here's this horrible, I always start out with these horrible questions. Like sometimes I just flat out ask people to rate themselves, which is very awkward, like when we're talking about relationships and stuff. So here's a little exercise of rating. If you could chart your spiritual life on some kind of a bell curve, so you're just, you know, starting out at conversion and where you are now, highs, valleys, lulls, stops, starts. I mean, have you had a pretty consistent growth in Christ and understanding of the gospel in your life? Or have there been like deserts? What does it look like? Any thoughts on that?
I think for me, right now, I in my phase of life, I've got a lot going on. I've got little kids at home. And so for me, I have to model my faith to them. But then also, I've been hearing a lot about grace a lot lately, in the last couple of years probably, and that has really spoken a lot to my heart and opened up a lot of doors. My relationship with my dad wasn't the best, and so having that father figure in God has been really hard for me to cling to. And so now understanding grace and grasping onto that has really meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
I think for me, I am further along in my walk and coming to know the Lord from a household that didn't know him at all. I really had to begin to live out my faith because they thought I was joining a cult. Mm-hmm. And so for them, anything that I said or did looked like it was something strange and that any moment I'm going to drink the Kool-Aid. So how do you live out the life when you don't even know what that life is supposed to look like? So I think the prayer I use the most and still do is just give me wisdom to know how to handle a situation that would reflect Christ and not me. Mm. And so there are ups, there's downs, mm-hmm. there's times when you wonder, is he even here? Does he even hear me? Maybe my parents were right after all. So I think you do go through those dry desert times, but I know that he did die for me, and I always went back to that's where my hope lies. Mm-hmm. And now I just need wisdom to know how to handle this situation today, and what does that look like to somebody else who's watching me? Mm.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can relate a lot with both of you guys, but I think for me, maybe 10, 15 years into this thing, that bell curve, I could have related to that early on, but in the last 8 years, there's no smoothness to how I could relate my journey with God. It's chaotic and it's mm-hmm. up and down, and the dry seasons feel more regular and comfortable than the mountaintops these days. I've learned to really see and appreciate the creator and sustainer of life through times when he seems to be apparently absent. So I don't know how I would place that on the curve, but mm-hmm. Short answer to the question, I guess, would just be where I'm at right now is grappling with that void again, as always, where I have this truth in my mind and my heart that I know God is, and trying to understand how he relates to friends and people and circumstances where it seems like he's not there. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't necessarily change too much, except for I'm relating to him in new ways.
Yeah. So, Bobby, that's interesting. Can you explain that a little bit? Because I think a lot of people will think, oh, the more mature you become in your faith, the closer you go to Christ, you're going to just, you have more answers. All of a sudden you understand, but yet you're saying it's like chaotic. Why would anyone want to grow in their faith if they're going to become more chaotic
well,
in their understanding of God?
Sure. I mean, I think growing in your faith, you have to ask, what is faith? And you talked about sin and going to heaven, and there's a couple of ways to think about that, but one of them is that sin is the thing that punishes us. It's not so much that we're punished by our sin, but we have this concept of something that distances us from our creator and from ourself and our own full potential as humans. And sin can be one of the things that creates a void between who we can be as fully alive and who we are. Mm-hmm. So the void in the faith there, I think, is more, a lot of times I understand what Jesus is saying is, I'm inviting you to be fully alive now. Mm-hmm. Not that if you sin a lot, you'll be dead forever, but that you might even be more dead right now or walking dead, like a little bit of a zombie. And I can relate to that. A lot of times I look back on the last couple months of my life and it's like, man, I was kind of dead the last few months. And my temptation a lot of times is just try and work myself into life again, which doesn't ever really work. That lasts maybe 30 hours and then mm-hmm. I'm just falling on my face. So for me, that lived faith you're asking about, you said, what does it mean to have a faith that's chaotic and void? It's more of an empowering to be able to live fully alive because there's this life force that I allow to come in and through me. And that makes it so that not everything is pretty and clear, but so that at least there's life amidst the chaos, life amidst the doubt and fear and sadness. And I was talking to a friend the other day, and they said, why are you so excited about like sadness and pain right now? And I wouldn't say I am, but I can just say I relate just as much to the Creator in the times that are sad and the times that are happy, mm-hmm. where it's almost like those are both life. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say yes to life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because we're actually going through, and I want to ask your all of your thoughts on this. We're going through Revelation right now at church, and so it's a renewed awareness of the fact that this isn't just like life where you make choices and they're kind of made in a vacuum and you kind of just go through and live the American dream and stuff, but the whole concept of a spiritual battle and what it looks like to live in a world where the devil is defeated, but still at this point has this weird tension of having some power. And my pastor yesterday, in fact, made the comment of, you know, how do you know there's a test to determine if you are a Christian engaged in spiritual warfare, and it's to take two fingers and put it on the side of your neck. And if you have a pulse, then you are. What does that mean for you all? Because I think especially those of us in Western culture, it's very easy just to deny that entirely and feel like we're just going to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. If we just kind of fly under the radar and live an okay life, then, you know, Jesus will just be like, okay, whatever. But really recognizing the reality of there's actually decisions being made out there and battles being fought and things happening that very directly affect us. How does that apply to you all?
I think that sometimes we think that this life is about us. Mm-hmm. And so we are more...
I like to think that.
Well, yes. And that's what I'm saying.
Only at least 4 days a week. Okay. The other days I'll give to the Lord.
Are you sleeping during those days?
I don't know.
Yeah. And I think that's part of our problem is that we hold on to this life so tightly that we forget the eternal perspective in what it is that we are doing or where it is we are going. Therefore, we hang on really tightly to the things that are around us, our children, our family, our house, our belongings, rather than saying, I'm passing through. I should have my belongings on my back, only the things I can carry, because it's not about me. It's about Christ. And I have to remind myself of that all the time. So when I get into a situation, I think, oh, why is this happening to me? Rather than how is this going to glorify God and move ahead for the kingdom to come? Because like you mentioned at the beginning, we already are in eternity, but I don't live that way. Mm-hmm. I live today, right now, where's my cup of coffee? Mm-hmm. And I think that's so sad that we do have a very selfish mindset about our lives and what we're even doing here. Mm-hmm.
I find that visual of spiritual warfare to be very exciting and inspiring for me. Mm-hmm. I love fantasy stuff, so like Lord of the Rings and big broadswords and everything, and thinking of the angels up there that are doing their duels, it's just exciting, and that helps me to be more mindful in my decisions and what I do.
Yeah. I just don't want to be the one picking up the sword.
No.
And, that's right. Yeah. And ducking.
I'll let them do their work.
Yeah, let them do their part. But
they can stand in front of me.
Right, but please don't make that affect my life right now.
Right.
Because I have things to do, and this isn't one of them.
Yeah. All right. So how do we take that into the practical? So like Diane, you mentioned, you know, waking up and getting your cup of coffee. I think it's so easy to live a day without consciously understanding our relationship to the Creator or our, you know, the reason why we're even here or ultimately what the fact that we're living in eternity, what that even means. How do you infuse into your everyday life an understanding of God's relationship with you in the very practical things, or even along the lines of, the fact that we always talk about, like, we have a testimony and we treat that like just our conversion experience. But really, we all should be having hundreds of testimonies of God's goodness, of his work in our life, of his forgiveness, of everything throughout the week. And so what do you guys specifically look for, or how do you notice that in your everyday life?
Well, can I say this? God is so faithful to shake us because in and of ourselves, we will just sit comfortably. Mm-hmm. And really, it's his job to shake our world enough for us to stop and really say, oh no, this isn't going smoothly. Mm-hmm. Now what do I do? So I have to continually turn to him. So those things that come into my life that disrupt my routine, I think they're an interruption. And he's saying, you forgot about me. And that's why this is here. And I'm going to show you how we're going to work through it. I think he's the one that's faithful to shake us up, because in and of ourselves, we're little sheep. And I just have my head down and I'm eating my yummy grass. And I'm not even aware that there's a wolf that's prowling around. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be Christ in me who will bring the storm, will bring the what happened to the grass. It was here a minute ago. Or that rushing flood that comes by. Otherwise, I'm very content. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's still a struggle for me when I face those dark times to turn to him and know that he's got me in his hands. But for me, on an everyday basis, it's gratitude. I look at the leaves outside that are turning colors right now, and I'm so grateful for the beauty that he's provided. My kids, I'm grateful for them, even though I could throttle them sometimes. it's awesome. And I think having that basis for my spirituality is really central.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, practically speaking, when you talk about the war being fought and the battles and the swords clanging, I think a lot of the times the way the battle is played out is a lot more like your neighbor next to you in the backyard is just annoying you because their dog won't stop barking.
Small things, right.
Yeah, right. And that's where the empowerment of the Spirit can come out. And I think one of the things Jesus modeled was a new way of thinking and a new way of living. It was less about I think it was less trying to help us get to a place that we aren't and more about helping us recognize the redemption of the place where we currently are. So one story is I walk out of my house every day. This dog comes attacking us next to the door. and it's scary, it's frightening, we're dropping coffee all over the place. This goes on for months and months and months. Well, eventually we just thought, why don't we just make friends with the dog? So we decided to go over to the neighbor's house, bring some cookies, we're petting the dog, learning the dog's name, and slowly it's becoming a relationship. And that's just one of the ways where you can think about a creative way to allow lives to overlap, and I think that's one of the things Jesus was modeling.
Mm-hmm. And I think we have family members that are like that dog.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Family members, coworkers.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Let's not name names.
Yeah, no, okay. Right, okay, yeah. And they rush at you, and your coffee goes all over the place. Mm-hmm. And I think God brings those into our lives so that we can see the selfishness of our nature. You know, you're disturbing me. This is not what I like. What's the matter with you? Why can't you be nice to me? Mm-hmm. And I think those are the things that just remind us again, we're here for an eternal purpose and not for today. If it was just for salvation, we would have been saved and gone. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that's what this was all about, why does he leave us here for so long? Mm-hmm. Because it's not just about the fact that we do get to go to heaven, but he wants to sanctify us along the way.
Yeah. And I like what you just said about having the relationship with the dog, because that's what it is all about, is a relationship with God and with others. It's just neat to see how that played out. That's really cool.
Yeah, sure. And you talked a little bit about Revelation earlier, and you can reframe that paradigm a little bit and say Revelation is more about the account of the enthroning of Jesus, which maybe has happened already, and the kingdom has been coming since the time. And all of a sudden, that puts things like the dog and the dirt and the soil in the backyard next to me, that puts it on a much higher scale of importance. Mm-hmm. When everything is in the process of being redeemed and made new and glorified, then you can see the world, you can see people through a lens that says you are inherently good. And then we just get to investigate and see, now where in the world are you good and how can I see that?
Yeah. Let's talk just briefly about the elephant in the room when it comes to the gospel in our lives and living out the Christian life, and that is the spiritual disciplines, which I think everyone is just like, you hear a sermon about it, and you know, you knew everyone who went to youth group knew you should read your Bible every day, and you need to pray, and you need to and all these things that we can easily make little tasky things that we're putting in our day timers, and then we fail at, and then we feel bad, and then we're like, I don't love Jesus. Mm-hmm. How have you reconciled that into your own lives, and where has God truly shown up when you have made the time to meet with him in your own unique way, and it could look differently for different people?
I'm so glad you asked that. For me personally, everyone has different personalities and processes and systems, but I know that when my time where I'm reading or praying or thinking, when it is regimented and I'm really done a good job with it, that I'm like farthest away from God during those times. So that's not what a lot of people would say. Maybe it is, but I feel like if we can allow...
I kind of looked a little backslidden.
I
wish I could be liberated from the pressure to have a quiet time every day. If I was allowed to not do that every day, it seems like there'd be this freedom that comes. So sometimes I give myself a little bit of grace, and then I find myself yearning to be with the Creator, and it seems a little bit more genuine, authentic, and a little bit less like checking the box. And sometimes when I check the box and I feel like that has been checked well, almost wells up inside of me a different kind of feel goodness that comes from a place of achievement and not a place of grace. So sometimes those spiritual disciplines, of course, they're good. We need to follow them. Other times we got to make sure that they're out of a natural flow of love and reverence for God and not out of a desire to please or perform for him.
Mm-hmm. And I think, again, he brings these situations into our lives where we have no other choice but to go to the Word to find that wisdom and peace that we need. Otherwise, we just forget. The food is there. I eat it. Mm-hmm. And then you realize the food's not there. Mm-hmm. I'm hungry. Why am I hungry? Mm-hmm. Because the food's not there. Mm-hmm. And he does bring those things into our lives just to remind us again, yoo-hoo, I'm the shepherd, and I'm going to move you along to where the grass is green. So there's highs, there's lows, there's ups, there's downs. There's that dryness time. And even that, you know, they sent poor Moses out into the desert for 40 years. And why did they do that? And it was very dry out there. That would not be my first choice. Mm-hmm. And it's because he had to learn through the desert that he's our provision.
One practical thing that I have done, because I have a tough time sitting down and reading and being very focused, but I get a daily email from Bible Gateway where I get a verse of the day. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I check my email every day, so that helps get a little bit of the word in. Mm-hmm. But then also, we live in this awesome, beautiful place where we have mountains right outside our front door where I can go out and just see the majesty of his creation and be grateful and say thank you. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that's good. So just one last thought, if everyone can give me their thought on this really quickly, the idea of community and its role in this, because I think kind of back to the dog example, you know, we think of that as, oh, these angry people or these people that hate Jesus. And so they're just going to be all up in our grill. But sometimes it's like the Christians that are kind of the most refining for us, because we're like, you should know better, people. Why are you treating me poorly? Or why are you getting all in my space and everything? And it's very easy for me to listen to a bunch of sermons or to like read books on theology. But then all of a sudden, when I live in community with people, I get crazy. And all of a sudden, I'm this weird, angry person that doesn't look like I've read any scripture. So how practically, how is that? How have you guys reconciled that to just understanding God in the midst of that?
For me, community is an absolutely essential part of our Christian faith. Mm-hmm. And community can look like a lot of different things. It can mean like, looks like you live with your spouse. It can mean that you work with people who are humans and they're in your community. It can mean you're in a class with other people. But the more intimate you get in community, whether that's with your friends or your family, the more space there is for your sin to be recognized by others. Mm-hmm. Or I guess you could say the less space there is for sin to exist and for you to have a normal functioning relationship. So for me, community, almost like you said, God is the one who shakes things mm-hmm. up and creates space. Community opens our eyes to ways that we are not as fully thriving as we could be. And when we have an open and honest community that has space for open communication, then it's almost like a mirror where you can see where and how you can grow and learn. And I think that's hard to do in our society.
And it's painful.
It's hard. It's painful. It's uncomfortable.
Right. And you have to decide whether or not, how, do I really want to grow?
Yeah.
Or am I really happy right now? And if I really want to grow, then I have to allow people to see, gosh, she's not that great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's okay.
Well, we could go on all day. I think we'll have to start just living this out. And of course, those of you out there, we want to hear how you're doing it as well. Find us on the blog and weigh in with your own stories and just where God's met you through this process of growth. Thanks, you guys, for being part of this.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is awesome.
Oh, God, dear. I hear you, you really want me to walk up to that mountain and tell it just to move. This is crazy, yeah. But I'm trusting, 'cause with you I know that all things are possible, and I can walk on water if you're calling me to you, and it's crazy, yeah. Lord, this scares me, yeah, but it's gonna take crazy faith. So what if it cost everything? I'm stepping out, I'm taking the leap of crazy faith.
Well, folks, we are here for this week's culture segment, and I'm always excited when we can introduce you to a new book that has something to do with you. And that is this week. We're going to be talking about 20 things we'd tell our 20-something selves. And so I have Kelly and Peter Worrell here. Hey, welcome, you guys.
Hi.
Very great to have you. They are both, well, obviously co-authoring this book, but they're both college professors at Moody. And we love our friends over at Moody. I do Moody Radio a lot. And so they're a fun bunch. But you also have two adopted kids. So your parents.
We do.
And we're assuming, because you wrote the book, you're out of your 20s. And we'll be
a little bit. Yeah.
We'll be looking back on this season. But that's great, because I'm big on telling our audience about having mentors and looking to people who've already walked through this stage of life. So this is going to be fabulous. You also have a connection to my alma mater, Trinity, on the North Shore of Chicago.
Couple
so
connections.
Obviously, we just have to pump that a little bit too.
Yeah.
So, but no, you guys are fabulous. So I want to launch straight into this, because we have tons of 20-somethings in our audience. And kind of one of the first, I guess, things that I'd like to just straight up ask is, looking back on your 20s for each of you, because you kind of grew up in different scenarios. Peter, you over in the UK, and Kelly in Minnesota, right?
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Yeah.
So also a connection there with me. Oh, my goodness.
Ah,
so, but nice. What when you look back on that decade, is it something overall kind of positive, or overall that you're just like, there were a lot of missteps there, over, you know, especially comparing to what 20-somethings are kind of walking through today?
Yeah, yeah, great question. And we actually open the book with each kind of telling our own stories. Mm-hmm. So I tell the story of me in my 20s. And for me, I graduated from college. And I think it was maybe a little bit easier back then to get a job right out of college. I see some of our students have a harder time, I think, than we did. So absolutely. I got a job right away, came to Chicago, and started a job at a publishing company, a Christian publishing company, because I knew I wanted to be in ministry in some way. And so that was a overall good experience. I got to go to seminary at Trinity and study, and I was doing mission trips, and I was real involved in my church, doing youth ministry and so on. So there was a lot of positive going on, but there's a lot of struggle as well. And so I talk in the book about how, you know, on the surface, you might have looked at me and had my own little apartment and I was loving life. But deep down, there was a lot of loneliness, for one thing, a lot of struggle with that, and just finding community and creating community all on my own. I found that pretty difficult. But we also talk about in the book how we tell our story of our 30s, because Peter and I met and married just before we turned 30. And when we got into our 30s was when we really hit some really tough life stuff. Mm. And we struggled with infertility for several years, some failed adoptions along the way. Both of my parents passed away, and we were caring for them in our home. Peter's dad passed away quite young. And during that time, my faith really was on the knife edge, and really difficult, struggle with depression, anger toward God. And so that was a really difficult time. And so the origin of this book actually was me kind of looking back on my 30s as well, and thinking, you know, in my 20s, you would have looked at me and thought I was doing it all, you know, doing all the Christian thing pretty well. And yet I come up into my 30s, I'm like, what happened? Mm-hmm. What happened? And so the origin, again, was me looking back and thinking, could I have done some things differently in my 20s? Could I have grounded myself? Were there lessons I needed to learn that I would have helped, I guess, when we came up against those tough life things?
Mm-hmm. You asked, Lisa, whether the 20s were positive or negative. And for me, they were mixed. I had a lot of positive things because I had a chance of being footloose and fancy free. I graduated from my undergrad in Plymouth, England, and then went straight to Japan for 3 years on something called the Japanese Exchange and Teaching Program. I realized I was getting paid a lot of money there, actually, for not doing enough work. So I went to Pakistan for 2 years and spent a month in Afghanistan. And then I decided that I needed to get a master's. So I came to Moody Graduate School to do my first master's. And so it was just one adventure after the other, which was really, really good. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't feeding my soul in the way that I should. I was feeding myself full of adventure and life experiences. And part of the myth we're told is if you embrace enough experiences, then you'll find out who you are. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't quite true for me. I really needed, as you were talking about earlier to us, about a strong mentor. I needed some strong mentorship. And I found that among the professors of Moody Graduate School.
Yeah. One of your chapters in the book is, and all your chapter titles are really interesting. One is called Feed Yourself. What do you mean by this principle? And why is it kind of something that 20-somethings need to be aware of?
Yeah, well, we take a kind of a holistic approach to that chapter, Feed Yourself. And we start by talking about physically feeding yourself. Mm-hmm. Might be something that we aren't necessarily taught, is how to feed our bodies well. And obviously, culturally, we see both extremes. We see, we reference the movie Super Size Me. And, you know, we're a fast food culture and overeating and so on. And then the other extreme where we starve ourselves. So we talk about just physically learning how to feed ourselves well. But then, of course, more than that, even mentally, we talk about a healthy mind. And we aren't always necessarily equipped to feed ourselves mentally. We spend a lot of time taking in things, consuming media, consuming things that aren't feeding our minds in a healthy way. And Peter can talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, I've been reading some articles recently talking about how this generation's coming up through and we've coddled ourselves. I think it started happening with my age bracket. But then after that, we've protected ourselves from the hard conversations to such a degree that we don't know how to have hard conversations. And so Atlantic Magazine writes an article called Coddling the American Mind, and how we're not really thinking as sharply. So it's imperative to go back and maybe rediscover what we've missed and to spend some time in our 20s building up the the mind.
And then the third part of that is feeding our souls. That's what we build to. Of course, the most important is how do we feed our soul? And I think, again, we can fall into maybe a very passive role in feeding our soul. And we don't seek out and even seek to understand what is going to feed us spiritually. And I think it can look different for different people. I think we might, in our passive role, just think, well, I go to church on Sunday and that's where I get my spiritual feeding. Or it has to look like doing a particular Bible study for a half an hour every morning and that is what should feed my soul. But I think it's more holistic than that. And I think we need to take ownership of feeding our souls. And at the end of the chapter, we even give a sort of a menu of different things. I think I polled my friends on Facebook, actually asking them, what feeds your soul? And they gave me all sorts of wonderful examples, like going for a long run, sharing a meal with friends, meeting with my small group, music. Some of us can be very fed with music, experiencing the liturgy, just hanging out with my kids and et cetera, et cetera. So I think finding what feeds you is important, and then building that into your life.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think in looking back on my 20s, I remember being very passive about a lot of things in my 20s because my life was so crafted prior to that. I was told where to go to school, and even then entering into college was kind of the next thing. And then all of a sudden I'm out in the world and I'm like, I actually have choices to make, and didn't exactly know what to do with that. And one of the things you guys talk about in the book is adjusting your expectations, specifically when we're told certain things like, I think you guys mentioned the phrase, the world is our oyster. What, you know, why do we need to adjust expectations? I think we're so programmed, you know, especially young adults, to think, you know, be all you can be, you can do anything. If you want, you could be president of the United States. Well, we can't all be president. So how do we adjust those expectations?
Well, I was actually just reading an article about that this morning, and the article was saying that our happiness would be reality minus our expectations. And I think that's a really good equation to think about, because say if you have a problem with not feeling too happy, and then you think, well, what's the reality here? And really, in ages gone past, that would be that in my 20s, there were a time of hard graft, getting myself known, getting myself out there, just making a start. But with the everything is awesome kind of expectations that we have, when you're part of a team, what happens is that we end up then thinking, well, I'm going to come out of college and then somebody's going to realize that I stand out from among my peers, and then they're going to gift me this amazing position that just fits who I am. And if I'm just available and then they see my awesomeness, then I will shoot to the top. And that's my expectation, is to be at the top of my field within maybe, well, if it's a long, hard grind, within maybe 2 or 3 years, I'll be at the top of my field. And if you put those very high expectations and you take that away from reality, so reality minus my expectations, you end up with a negative number. And that ends up with this depression then of, well, I, you know, I have all these high hopes, all these high expectations, and it's not working out. Whereas in previous generations, they could be even a little bit too negative. And it would be, well, you know, I expect it to be really, really horrible, and I expect to hardly be able to find a job and feed myself. But, oh, look, you know, I've got something to give to my neighbor here. life's a little better. And so some positivity breaks out. So adjusting the expectations, we have to deal with what Kelly and I address in this chapter is the idea of should. What should happen? And if you go biblically on what should happen, You get to a place where I should be crucified on the cross. I should actually be eternally separated from God. I should have all these terrible things happen because of my sin. And if I start with that expectation and then I realize that I don't get crucified on a cross, I don't get eternally separated because of the person of Jesus Christ, then the whole idea of grace just floods into our lives and lifts us up to a much more positive place.
And I think media, and in particular social media, plays into our expectations as well. I think there are so many, you know, on a daily basis, we're confronted with what everybody else is doing with their life and the image that they want to present to us. And we're constantly measuring ourselves up against all of these images, whether it's the movies or social media. And so that, I think, develops these expectations in us, too, of what our life should be like. It should look like all these different ways, and, mm-hmm. and often it doesn't.
Well, and you both talk about another concept of taking risks in the book. And so, Peter, mm-hmm. you're, I mean, anyone listening to your story through your 20s is just like, well, that's just a course in amazingness right there. But what does it look like? Because I think there's this expectation, again, getting mm-hmm. back to that, that our lives are going to be this one, you know, plot line, and it's just going to be amazing. Right. And how can we healthily take risks without mm-hmm. just being dumb and being foolish
yeah.
in that?
Yeah. Yeah, there's an awesomeness that factor that people kind of think, well, you know, I want to be awesome. I don't want to be average. And so in a grasp for that, sometimes they'll make really dumb decisions. Fortunately, God is still God, mm-hmm. and he's rescued me from some really major dumb decisions I made in my 20s. Mm-hmm. So the thing is that with the God of Scripture, even if you do take a risk and you're not sure, you commit your way forward with God in mind, and I do make a distinction, with God in mind, then he will straighten your path and work it out. So when I was in northern Pakistan, for example, I got up in the middle of the night, one of our friends had gone for a walk, and I walked across a glacier in the middle of the night, and I heard it kind of moving and creaking and grumbling underneath me, mm-hmm. and then I was shouting, which again is something you don't do on summer ice, trying to find my friend. And I came back. Well, that I took a risk, but it wasn't a wise risk. And God preserved me in spite of my risk, knowing that other people have fallen straight through that glacier and gone into the water flow underneath. I found that out afterwards. But then there are other risks that I have two options, and one plays it safe and the other one feels uncomfortable. And we shouldn't let our feelings guide us. Dallas Willard, who I respect, has a lot to say about what the heart is, and the heart is the decision-making center of a person. And it isn't the emotion being the center of a person. So I can make a decision which is actually the right decision and still feel not so comfortable or good about it. Now, that's something that gets to the heart of some of our conversations with 20-year-olds, because they're like, I've made the right decision and I don't feel great about it, therefore it can't be the right decision. Hmm. Well, I've made some decisions, like to go to Pakistan, when I felt isolated and disconnected from my family. But over time, things confirmed that I was meant to be there, and my emotions conformed to my act of will later. And so you might need to stick out negative emotions when you take the risk and then endure into some adventure later. And God promises a life of significance and adventure, but he doesn't always promise a life of wonderful feelings and positivity. And sometimes you have to push through that.
Yeah.
We use the example of Moses from Exodus 3 and 4 in the chapter, and that idea of calling, which can be hard to talk about because mm-hmm. we don't often get a burning bush. It looks different, but I think God still does call us. And I think the promises that he gave to Moses still stand true. And of course, Moses was called to take a risk, and he felt completely inadequate for the task, which we often do when God calls us to these things, big things and small things. And yet God promises his presence, and he promises that his power will be going before us, and he promises that we will be used, that our purpose is that other people may believe. And so he calls us to those things, and then he will equip us. And so I think that when we take a risk, when it's something that God is calling us to do, we have the assurance of those things.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. And in light of that, I want you guys, kind of as we finish up here, to talk about it's just some thoughts that you have on community in light of that, because I think, again, you know, young adults, maybe they've grown up in church in the same youth group, then they go off to college, and especially those who go to secular universities, I think they underestimate the value of friendships and the groups that they get in there and how that will influence them. And then also the power of having adults speaking into your life. You know, we alluded to mentors mm-hmm. a little bit, but why is choosing a community so important, and then cultivating that even into your 20s and beyond?
Yeah, I think so much happens in community. And of course, community is such a biblical thing. We see it right from Genesis, you know, and even our God is three persons, and he created us. It is not good that man should be alone. He created us for community. And so much happens in community. You know, it's in community that we work out so much of our identity. Mm-hmm. We come to understand who we are and our place in the world. And so much of that happens in conversation with other people. And the other people that we're in community with speak into that. And so we come to understand our own identity. We come to understand the world around us through our community. And we also come to understand what is right and what is wrong. I mean, really, so much of our spiritual development happens in community. So I don't think we can underestimate the importance of it.
I've read Alan Hirsch's book, The Forgotten Ways, and in that he highlights the importance of communitas, which he separates from community. And with communitas, it's towards a particular purpose. So you know when you have a task to complete and everybody rallies around the task, there's a greater sense of purpose. But you see, for the people of God, we very often, unfortunately, lose our sense of purpose. Why are we meeting together? Why are we coming together for a Sunday service? Actually, in my church I grew up in, they had a gospel service on a Sunday night that nobody unsaved really came to in all of my memory of going there for 5 or 10 years. So, you know, there was this service, it had a particular purpose, it wasn't serving that purpose anymore, and people were getting together, and quite frankly, it was pointless. And so the devil loves a pointless gathering of people. He'll start to fill that space with gossip, and he'll start to fill that space with all kinds of horrible things. And I think 20-somethings know that. They're often very perceptive, and they come in and they realize, you know, I think I have more community down at the local bar. You know, there's more going on there. There's more meaningful conversation actually in a Starbucks than there is in church. And so they leave for that meaning. Well, if we reclaimed our purpose as the church, if we saw where God was taking us, if we had clear vision, and if we started to talk about that with each other, this is where God is moving, this is what God is doing, then I really think that 20-somethings, 30-somethings, teens, we'd all rally around together, seeing a role to play in that. And that's when communitas would break out, and not just this community, this gathering of people. It would be like, this is where we're going, this is what we're going to be doing, and this is how to get it done. And this is how we all have a voice in that process.
Great, great points. Well, the book, folks, is 20 Things We'd Tell Our 20-something Selves. I've been talking to Peter and Kelly Worrell. Great to have you part of this. And I'm so glad that a couple like yourself is speaking into the lives of university students even now through Moody and beyond. And of course, we'll have a link to the book. You can actually find out more about what Peter and Kelly have going on at peterandkelly, and that's kelli.org. Mm-hmm. So thanks, you two, for being part of this.
Thank you.
Thank you so,
so good to
much.
Be with you.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Let me tell you how love, love has spoken in my brokenness. I heard a sound. It was a still, small voice calling. It was ancient, it was now.
We finish out the show with our inbox every week, and this week we have Jackson Dunn back. Hey, Jackson, great to have you back here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Very fun. We love it when you can weigh in on stuff with us. And this one is a girl who has a question about her boyfriend and her and church. These are important things. Okay, she is saying, my boyfriend and I have been dating for more than a year. At this point, we feel we're on the track to marriage, but we come from two different denominations. Since we've been dating, we've attended his church. Now my parents are moving near me and have already expressed concern and expectations for me to attend church with them. It is important for my boyfriend and I to attend church together, so how do I help my family understand my decision without disappointing them or hurting anyone's feelings?
You know, this is dicey.
Yeah.
Oh, it hits close to home for me, too, because Krista and I came from very different backgrounds, my wife, and lots of fun, conversations, maybe, to put it that way, but lots of things that we work through. And I love this question. Love that they're going to church together. Love that she's looking at it as a we thing, engaging in church together. And, but because it's boyfriend, you know, because it's family moving close, this is dicey is a good word because of the element that that's going to bring into it. And so first of all,
especially as it moves towards marriage, if it
absolutely
does, then it gets, yeah,
if it does,
yeah.
Family, boyfriend. I mean, yes, we're in a committed relationship, but there's an an element when you are just dating where, I mean, obviously we're going to always honor and respect our parents, but the dynamic is a little different between fiancé and spouse and those types of things. Now, as you've heard me say often whenever we get to talk, is I always like to have someone start with themselves. You know, it's easy to point the finger to look at parents or look at boyfriend or look at the situation. One thing I would want to make sure before she even engages in this conversation is that she is very secure in this decision to go to this church. Mm-hmm. Why are you at this church? Was it originally pressure to go to his church? I mean, is this really your church in addition to our church, her and her boyfriend? And so, because when we're going to have that conversation with the parents, they're going to want to hear, hey, what if this boy wasn't in the picture? Mm-hmm. Are you able to serve the Lord here? Mm-hmm. Are you hearing him here? Is he guiding you and leading you? Are you being fed here? Do you have a community here? Those are all the things I would want her to start there, because regardless of looking towards this conversation with the parents, and that's going to be a little bit awkward, I would want to make sure that she's firm in this decision of attending this church, and it's for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, should they end up at the same church? Absolutely. Whether his, hers, or a completely different one, mm-hmm. which is kind of where Krista and I ended up landing, is that I would want to make sure that there's a secure nature to go into this church, and it's for the, quote, right reasons in the sense of her relationship with the Lord. Because this is a boyfriend, I would want her to, obviously we're going to lead with honor, mm-hmm. really leading with honor to the parents, of mm-hmm. being able to hear and to listen, not being defensive. But again, and not defending the choice to go, but allowing them to hear the reasons behind that. And again, what I would want her to know and them to know is it great that my boyfriend is here and we're doing this together? Yes. But is the picture even bigger than that of what I see that the Lord is doing and the time that I have to serve here and to go here and those kinds of things? And so if the answer is yes to all that from her, be able to have a very calm, collected, clear, firm conversation mm-hmm. with the parents. Because if this relationship is going towards marriage, this is not the first nor the last thing that she's going to have to say, as for me and our house, as mm-hmm. for me and this relationship, mm-hmm. these are the choices we're making. I know you may not agree. You may have another preference for something else, but this is what we believe. This is where we believe. This is why, whatever it is, whatever the situation, church or fill in the blank, it's going to be important that they can do those sorts of things together, make those decisions together, communicate those things well. This is great practice for the future as well.
Yeah, that's interesting, just because it makes me wonder if her parents are, you know, I think she's going to have to take into account and really hear her parents out, because are they concerned about the denominational difference, or do they just want their daughter with them? Because I think there can be some kind of weird attachment things in light of that. I mean, it's like,
goodness,
clearly they've been living away and now they're back. And so I think she might have to really stand her ground and say a few things. And like you said, that's why self-assessment and figuring out why she's there in the first place is a great, great point.
Yeah. And be open to this going lots of different directions. I mean, not trying to be discouraged. I mean, I kind of laugh when you're saying all the attachment or this, mm-hmm. there could be a lot of issues behind their desire to go to the church,
right,
and to a specific church. And it could have nothing to do with church. Mm-hmm. And so be willing to walk down many paths in this conversation. Mm-hmm. You may be seeking to figure out if this is the church or not, but what are the expectations they have for her beyond church in moving close? What are the expectations they have for their relationship? Do they think they're spending too much time? All these things that could come up. I would encourage her of, yes, have a clear answer and clear process for making the decision on the church, mm-hmm. but be open, not only in this one conversation, but future conversations of other things coming up. And again, if dealt with well in a godly way, in an honoring way, in a way that she's done first self-assessment, self-reflection, I believe she's not only going to find the answers moving down the road, but the relationship's going to get healthier.
Yeah. Well, great thoughts from Jackson Dunn. Thanks, Jackson.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's it for this week's show. We do want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org and hop over to the blog to comment and make sure you tell your friends. You may also want to hop on iTunes and give us a review if you've been enjoying the show, especially if you're a newer listener and haven't weighed in for too long or haven't had much to say about the show. We would love to hear from you over there as well. That's it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.